This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome, listeners, to the Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, August 17, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Today's first article is a Christian Science perspective from Jenny Sawyer. It's entitled, Continuing Education. It's that time of year when the glossy catalog showcasing my community's continuing education offerings have begun landing in mailboxes. With them usually comes a message about the lifelong opportunity to expand our horizons by learning new things. How true that is, not just in subjects such as music and languages, but also in our spiritual progress. In fact, my practice of Christian Science has shown me that the truly horizon-expanding education isn't just in studying religion like an academic subject, it's in more deeply knowing and understanding God. Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of this publication, was an ardent student of the Bible and found it indispensable to her spiritual search and eventual discovery of the science of being, which she called Christian Science. But it was more than just the words of a spiritual text that impelled this paradigm-shifting sense of God to dawn for her. As she explained it, the scriptures had to me a new meaning, a new tongue. Their spiritual signification appeared, and I apprehended for the first time in their spiritual meaning Jesus' teaching and demonstration and the principle and rule of spiritual science and metaphysical healing. It was something beyond mere human insight or understanding that opened these vistas for Mrs. Eddy. It was a palpable, practical, alive sense of what God is and all that means for us as His children, not created materially, but spiritually. She experienced something of the living presence of God, and that changed her, healed her. She then spent the rest of her life working to demonstrate, articulate, and teach this profound discovery, so that the rest of us could likewise experience more of God, good, and the spiritual laws that undergird and govern our lives. To those who asked how they could progress most rapidly in their own understanding, she left in part these instructions. Study thoroughly the letter and imbibe the spirit. In my life, I've come to see that it's getting beyond the head to the heart. Not just learning and thinking about God, but reaching for more of an experience of God, to feel the love of God as love, the life-sustaining power of God as life, the harmonizing of God as soul, to listen to, trust, and follow God because God is infinite intelligence, mind. Oftentimes, concepts that start out as interesting ideas that I've gleaned from my study of the Bible and science and health take root and blossom as I ask God for help in getting a less academic and more spiritual sense of what they mean. For example, I spent a full year praying about what it means that God is life. As I did, that idea went from feeling like notes on a page in a musical score to becoming like the music behind those notes, shimmering and singing to me in the most wonderful ways. At the end of that year, I even discovered that I didn't need to wear glasses anymore, just because I'd been perceiving more clearly that God is life itself. The continuing education that opens up new views of God to us has no season or registration deadline. It's there to be experienced daily as we open our hearts and let God show us who He and we truly are. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, August 17, 2026, comes from Stephanie Haynes, the print editor of the Christian Science Monitor. Her article is entitled, The Real Lessons of Back to School. There was a short chapter in my life when I was not concerned with going back to school. It was post-college, pre-children, and I remember the smugness of planning a vacation for early October. For what felt like forever, my late summers had revolved around number two pencils and class lists and the prickly anticipation sparked by names like Western Civilization or Biology 2. But then the months sprawled like a teenager in a hammock, and I won't lie, the break was nice. After a while, though, I realized a bit of me was ready for back to school again. This was before I had kids of my own, before they hoisted pint-sized backpacks and picked out special polka-dot leggings to wear for the first day. I just realized I missed September's sense of potential. Not in that self-focused way of many New Year's resolutions, but as an expansive sort of longing for new things to learn and new relationships to forge. That's where this special issue comes in. If you've experienced any of this, whether you are returning to school yourself or whether it's been decades since you thought about meeting a new teacher, this magazine is for you. Throughout these pages, our stories tackle some of the most debated topics in education today, from artificial intelligence to college finances. They also delve into the connections we make in the classroom, whether interspecies or international. Be sure to check out our special kid space. We designed it so you could pass it to the younger children in your life. In a lot of ways, the modern education system is an odd experiment. We take children away from their families, group them by age, and attempt to teach them a set of facts we think they all should know, from geometry to Shakespeare. So it's not surprising, perhaps, that the real lessons are not always about coursework. We asked children and teens at Camps Newfound and Owatonna in Maine for their best tips for day one at school. You'll find many of them sprinkled on the pages throughout this magazine. But here's a sample. Talk to people who look like they need a friend. Don't do things just because other people do it. Don't try to take it in all at once. Also, don't worry so much. Don't stress over grades. They won't matter in the end, but still try. Don't miss out on experiences. This, I realize, is what I had missed most about back to school. And it's this sense of humanity, alongside learning, that we hope you continue to find in our magazine. Next in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, August 17, 2026, are a series of articles from the Back to School section. The first one is entitled, After the College Left, a Town Reimagines Learning. Small colleges are closing across the United States. In Vermont, one community turned a shuttered campus into a different type of education destination. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Olivia Fletcher. Voices bounce off century-old farmhouse walls as actors rehearse for a theater production. Amid the gardens outside, picnic tables fill with attendees of a week-long writing retreat. And across the grounds, students at a therapeutic school rest in the shade of a tree. The scene among the pines and mountains of a small central Vermont town reveals how Plainfield, with a population of nearly 1,000 people, is finding a way to solve a problem vexing communities across the United States. Just 2 years ago, this buzzing commons was an empty college campus. Goddard College is one of nearly 2,000 federally funded higher education institutions that have closed over the past 30 years, and one of 17 four-year private nonprofit colleges to shut their doors in 2024 alone. Small, private, rural colleges are most susceptible to closures due to a combination of declining birth rates and students increasingly choosing the labor market or urban institutions, experts say. These numbers are only expected to grow. The Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education predicts that the number of high school graduates will steadily decline until 2041, reflecting a drop in births after 2007. This will likely lead to fewer traditional college applicants and more college closures. The communities these institutions call home often bear the economic, social, and cultural effects of their closures. Plainfield is working to restore what it lost by partnering with a private investor and the state to reinvent Goddard College as a vibrant community hub. The creative campus at Goddard redefines learning as something rooted in collaboration, creativity, and continuous growth, offering one model for another struggling college towns. Just the act of interacting with others on challenging topics does wonders to develop remarkable people, says Robert Kelchin, professor and head of the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. Trying to fill a cultural hole. Colleges are often one of the largest employers in rural communities, Dr. Kelchin says. When they close, not only do faculty and staff lose their jobs, but the surrounding economy suffers as local businesses lose customers, which can trigger cascading job losses, prolonged economic depression, and population decline. But college closures don't just leave the economic hole, they leave a cultural hole in the community as well, Dr. Kelchin says. Nathan Grawry, professor of economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, says the students as well as the campus employees and their families can strengthen local K-12 schools, for example. The creative campus in Plainfield hopes to reimagine this cultural and intellectual life that Goddard College once brought. After Goddard closed its doors in spring of 2024, Michael Davidson, founder of New Hampshire-based property rental company Ledgeworks Incorporated, bought the 131-acre campus for $3.4 million. He worked alongside town members and the select board to understand their aspirations and needs for the space and has redeveloped it for community use. The partnership now acts as an umbrella lessee, overlooking other nonprofits that rent campus buildings, including youth support organizations, a community radio station, and a sustainable food network. Mr. Davidson and the Creative Campus Board, many of whom are former Goddard faculty members, continue to create a space for people of all ages to live, convene, and learn. In the former Goddard mail room, where students once collected letters and packages, neighbors now gather for dinner at the new restaurant. The campus rose garden has traded silence for the sounds of weddings and concerts. Colorful buildings that once housed Goddard students are now available to Vermont youth in need. The property's manor house, once a Goddard College library and event space, now serves as a rehearsal space for the Goddard Institute of Dramatic Arts. Barbara Vicar, former Goddard president and now board member of the Creative Campus, and Chris Gruen, director of the Creative Campus and Haybarn Theater Arts, say the Creative Campus repurposing works because it breaks down the historic divide between the college and its community. Rather than turning inward during difficult times, the campus meets genuine needs. But the learning continues. Favor Ellis, Executive Director of Elevate Youth Services, a youth well-being and development nonprofit, found kinship through the integrated campus community. Proximity matters, Ms. Ellis says. It tells a young person without anyone having to say it out loud that they belong somewhere ordinary and alive, not somewhere set apart for people who need fixing. As the campus fills with new people and purpose, another idea has taken shape. Education doesn't have to end when a college closes. The Creative Campus team emphasizes lifelong learning, project-based learning, and learning by doing. The hope is that learning happens in living in the community also, Ms. Vicar says, that it doesn't necessarily have to be a course that's being offered, but there is this kind of informal learning that happens when you live in a community. Actors and writers swap stories, for example. Nonprofit staff on campus share advice with other organizations. Ms. Vicar and Mr. Gruen emphasize that while this model of repurposing is working at Goddard, there's no one-size-fits-all solution for towns that lose colleges. They believe successful campus repurposing requires collaboration, a coordinated system of state support and funding, and a private owner who understands regional needs. I think this is a moment where we all have to put our real collaboration and creativity into thinking and let go of our attachment to what has been and really ask, what can be now, Ms. Vicar says. The next article from the back-to-school section of your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, August 17, 2026, is entitled, Parents Push for Less YouTube, More Books in Schools. a backlash against technology in schools is growing as concerns mount over screen time. And this article is written by contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, Stephanie Cook Broadhurst. Miriam Kendall has never gotten her children an iPad. She doesn't allow screens at home, except for limited TV time. So when her oldest daughter was handed a tablet in kindergarten, it felt to her like opening a Pandora's box. She came home and said, "Mommy, you have to let me watch YouTube," recalls a mother of three from Evanston, Illinois. Miss Kendall, who encourages her children to play outside and not on devices, held the line on her household rule. But when her daughter entered second grade, Miss Kendall found something concerning when she checked the school tablet's tracker. His daughter had spent 2 hours watching Taylor Swift videos at school when she should have been learning. She wondered, did the school have a clear policy on technology use? She reached out to other parents who shared her concerns. Today, Ms. Kendall, founder and director of parent group Screen Sense Evanston, is leading the charge in her neighborhood and with others nationwide to unplug kids from devices in classrooms. She speaks at school board meetings and lobbies for screen time limits and a return to pencil and paper learning, particularly in elementary grades. We want there to be a really thoughtful and strategic re-evaluation of the use of technology in schools, says Ms. Kendall, who launched a petition last year to limit screen time that garnered over 1,400 signatures in her local pre-K through 8th grade district of about 6,000 students. This is widespread. Parents are demanding change. Indeed. Parents from California to Illinois to Pennsylvania are pushing back against technology they say creates distractions, negatively impacts learning, and conflicts with screen time limits set at home. Many had heeded the advice of Jonathan Haidt's best-selling book, The Anxious Generation, to limit digital exposure, only to find themselves undermined by the place that is supposed to be most attuned to child development, the classroom. How in the world are you providing these highly addictive, highly distracting devices to every single student in the district? Asked Ms. Kendall, who wants to see clearer policies and more staff training. From a tech surge to growing caution. A decade ago, many districts across the United States raced to close the homework gap and digital divide as educators viewed technology as essential for preparing students for a modern world. They signed multi-year contracts with technology companies and invested billions of dollars into digital tools such as iPads and Chromebooks. In 2020, the pandemic accelerated the trend as districts used federal coronavirus relief fund money to invest in technology and remote learning. When students returned to classrooms, parents had hoped to trade tablets for textbooks, as it became clear technology could not replace in-person learning. Today, many school districts have still not fully recovered from historic academic declines in student achievement due to school closures and remote learning, according to the National Assessment of Educational Progress. Nobody stepped back after COVID and took a fresh look at the use case for the iPad and the school policies and said, is this the optimal way to use the tool? Says parent Aaron Friedman of Glenview, Illinois, who launched a petition to limit devices last spring that garnered 1,000 signatures. In spring 2020, about 45% of public schools assigned devices to individual students, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. By the 2024-25 school year, that figure had nearly doubled. Around 88% of public schools had one-to-one computing programs, which provide every student with a school-issued device. Organizers point to growing evidence that shows excessive screen time harms children, including the United States Department of Health and Human Services advisory issued in May, linking it to poor student well-being. Many of these parents helped drive the national Wait Until 8th Grade pledge movement to delay smartphones until 8th grade, which over 155,000 families have signed. they're also mobilizing to support school-wide cell phone bans. At least 37 states now require school districts to ban or restrict student cell phone use during class time, according to Education Week. At school board meetings across the United States, parents have reported kids playing video games in class and students watching pre-recorded lessons instead of learning from a teacher. Part of the solution, parents say, is to let students dig in the dirt during science class or leaf through a library book during English. Parent Jordan Specklemeyer of Morton, Illinois, runs a device-free home for her first-grade son and two-year-old daughter. She understands that screens can play a role in learning, but she wonders, are they better than a human teacher? Ms. Specklemeyer points to how some learning apps are designed to be highly addictive. She's concerned ed tech companies are profiting from children's education and prefers to use paper flashcards with students she tutors instead of quiz apps that often have pop-up ads. Internet Safety Labs, a nonprofit research group, reported in 2022 that 96% of educational apps share children's data with third parties, often unbeknownst to students, parents, or schools. Educators suggest the question isn't whether technology belongs in classrooms, but how it's used. Research shows digital tools can improve literacy and STEM comprehension when used with teacher oversight. A 2024 meta-analysis across 119 studies in the Review of Educational Research looked at ed tech's effect on literacy in K through 5 grades and found positive outcomes for reading comprehension and writing proficiency. But some parents want more say in how their children learn, including the right to remove their students from screen-based instruction. Parents in the Lower Merion School District in Pennsylvania drew national attention in June when yelling broke out at a board meeting after the district repealed a policy that had given families a chance to opt out. Many districts, including Lower Merion, are reexamining their policies. After facing pressure from parents and the groups, Schools Beyond Screens, the Los Angeles Unified School District in June approved a ban on classroom screen time for students through first grade, while gradually increasing access in higher grade levels. Meanwhile, at least 16 states have introduced or enacted legislation to limit screen time or take a closer look at ed tech policies. Since launching her petition in Evanston, Ms. Kendall says her district has banned YouTube and over 300 non-educational apps from school-issued devices. The district also agreed to screen-free indoor recess, she says. The Evanston Skokie School District 65 did not respond to requests for comment. When Mr. Friedman brought parents' concerns to his school board in Glenview last spring, they listened. Our district takes this very seriously, says Mr. Friedman, who has a third grader. Within a matter of weeks, they came back and instituted meaningful changes, he says, including a decision to review and clarify appropriate use policies for technology in classrooms. Parents agree technology, when properly supervised, can help students conduct research, take online exams, or learn multimedia skills. College students Nadia Easley from Northbrook, Illinois, learned how to type and code in middle school at a private school, Willows Academy. But getting taught by humans is what she remembers most. She grew to love her least favorite subject, history, thanks to a teacher who made the class engaging. A survey of 600 United States teachers in May found that 85% believe students spend too much time on screens in class, according to researchers at Auburn University College of Education and Christopher Newport University. It's soft skills that matter most, and those are learned face-to-face with good in-person interactions, says Kim Whitman, a parent from Overland Park, Kansas, and organizers with Distraction-Free Schools Policy Project. Kids coming out of school need to be able to speak to people and look them in the eye. The next article from the Back to School section in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, August 17, 2026, is entitled, Education's AI Gold Rush Comes with Risks. As Silicon Valley titans and startups cash in, educators and parents struggle to decide which tools help and harm. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Aaron Glantz. Across the United States, financially strapped school districts are spending increasing amounts of money on artificial intelligence products, despite a growing body of research showing AI can harm children's ability to think. Education's AI sector, virtually non-existent before ChatGPT's release in 2022, grew to $730 million in 2026, according to a report prepared for the monitor by Future Market Insights. The research firm projects the market for AI in K through 12 education will grow by 40% annually for the next decade, reaching $18.5 billion in 2036. The beneficiaries, observers say, are a growing list of companies with names like Magic School, School AI, and Buddy. They seek to profit from a quandary increasingly facing educators. Students and teachers are already using AI, but not always in a way that facilitates learning. My students can put a homework question into Google, and the AI summary will give them the answer, says Merrick Chang, who teaches chemistry and biology at Los Altos High School in the San Gabriel Valley outside Los Angeles. The tech companies say their specialized AI products provide the solution. AI can help teachers write lesson plans and grade papers, saving them time. The companies say while personalized learning bots cater to students' individual needs and produce spectacular academic gains. But without a significant body of research proving these tools' efficacy and some studies showing harm, a growing number of experts are worried that children have become the guinea pigs of the next big tech experiment. There has been an absolute gold rush, says Chris Hagel, chief information officer at the Peninsula School District outside Tacoma, Washington. Meanwhile, frontier AI firms Anthropic and OpenAI have announced they are offering their Claude and ChatGPT products to educators for free, but only temporarily. Anthropic's commitment to a complimentary service for educators expires June 2027. OpenAI's expires June 2028. They want to capture the market. We've seen this many times before, says Chris Agnew, director of Generative AI for Education Hub at Stanford University. In an interview, OpenAI's vice president of education, Leah Belsky, declined to speculate on whether ChatGPT would remain free for educators, but she said helping teachers is part of the company's mission. Anthropic did not respond to multiple requests for comment. Balancing promise with peril. According to the Center for Democracy and Technology, an estimated 85% of teachers and 86% of students already utilize generative AI in their schoolwork. The Trump administration has pushed school districts to incorporate AI. In July 2025, the Department of Education, which Mr. Trump seeks to dismantle, issued guidance that encourages educators to harness the potential of AI by utilizing high-quality AI instructional materials and deploying AI-enhanced high-impact tutoring. But the department has not set standards to help local officials to vet these tools. In April 2025, Education Secretary Linda McMahon elicited cackles from the administration's critics when she mistakenly referred to AI as A1 in a speech at Arizona State University. Without federal standards, more than 30 states have adopted their own guidelines. A few, in Wyoming and North Carolina, have provided districts with robust frameworks to balance the technology's promise with its peril. Part of Wyoming's guidance is a video on the State Department of Education website titled Threat Assessment. It begins with a warning. AI is already here, it says. inside the EdTech tools you'll probably be already paying for, before adding that without federal standards, the job just got harder. Because all the responsibility for checking every single tool for safety, for privacy, for whether it even works, that now falls squarely on you. The video then lays a laundry list of red flags, from apps that collect data on students to those that target them with advertisements to those that may harm their ability to learn. Wyoming's Department of Education also provides vetting tools to districts, one of them developed by Project Unicorn, a consortium of nonprofit organizations and school associations, is a chatbot that evaluates other AI applications. Project Unicorn's website includes its own disclaimer. While every effort has been made to ensure accuracy and relevance, please treat all information as guidance and informational rather than final legal, technical, or purchasing advice. The lack of clarity around the new technology has opened the door for corruption, some worry. On June 21, Los Angeles Unified School District Superintendent Alberto Carvalho resigned after his home was raided by the FBI amid an investigation into a district contract for an AI chatbot. 2 weeks later in New York, schools Chancellor Kamar Samuels asked principals to pause purchases of AI software after New York City Council members demanded a moratorium on AI's use at schools until rigorous guardrails can be developed with public and expert input to prevent serious damage to NYC children and their future. A broader petition seeking a 2-year moratorium on generative AI use in the city schools has generated thousands of signatures. Industry's Sunny Vision. In Silicon Valley, a rising cadre of founders offers a far sunnier vision of AI's impact on education, exhibiting characteristically brash confidence while issuing bold statements about their technology's power to uplift children and transform learning. Among the competing startups is Bloomie, an AI learning bot developed by Alex Southmayed, a former McKinsey and Company consultant. Mr. Southmayed once recruited drivers for Lyft, the ride-hailing company. Now he is building Bloomie at Y Combinator, the San Francisco tech incubator that has helped launch a long list of Silicon Valley titans, including Airbnb and DoorDash. Why have a teacher lecture 30 students at once when each student can receive a customized lesson that's perfect for them? Mr. Southmayed asks. He imagines a world where students receive AI-enabled personalized instruction from his Bloomie app, gamified through the receipt of Bloomie Bucks for correct answers to be redeemed with a teacher. Mr. Southmayed says he knows parents are worried about the damaging effect excessive screen time can have on their children, but he argues his app is good for kids' development. Social media, as well as many ed tech platforms, erodes focus and mental resilience, he says. We structure the experience so that students find satisfaction and effort, patience, and mastery rather than passive consumption. Mr. Southmayed says pilot results, mostly in charter schools, shows his app improves student performance in both writing and math. But like most of its competitors, Bloomie's performance has not been subject to randomized control trials that compare it to regular school instruction. According to Stanford's Mr. Agnew, the effectiveness of personalized learning chatbot has yet to be independently established by researchers. Very few rigorous studies have even been conducted, he says. I have not seen anything that shows we can replace the human teacher, nor should we, he adds. Indeed, Mr. Agnew's center at Stanford has documented a performance cliff born of intellectual outsourcing to AI. While students using unrestricted AI show immediate performance improvement while using AI agents, their performance plummets once the tool is removed. Education experts say this is in line with what we're learning about the impact of AI use among adults. In February, a team of researchers from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business published a study that found use of artificial intelligence was reshaping human reasoning and leading to cognitive surrender. The study involved 1,300 participants and 10,000 trials. Robbie Torney, head of digital and AI assessments for the nonprofit Common Sense Media, says school districts should remember the fundamentals of what's known to work in education. A sense of belonging, connection to a teacher, and connection to community, which motivates students to learn. Mr. Southmayed counters that his company does not seek to replace teachers, but wants to free them up for more one-on-one instruction. I don't know any teacher who feels they have too much time, he says. No firm is better positioned to benefit from the growth of AI in education than Google, which has gifted millions of Chromebook laptops to children and whose software suite, Google Classroom, is already used by most school districts. With minimal fanfare, Google has integrated its Gemini and Notebook LM AI tools into the Google Classroom suite. Consumer testing of Gemini by the nonprofit group Common Sense Media, however, found the version of Gemini being made available to schools has the same safety problems as the consumer version. The group rated Gemini for schools high risk. Among other things, Common Sense Media found Gemini's K-12 chatbot treats a sixth grader the same as a high school senior, providing identical responses despite vast developmental differences, and could surface inappropriate content. Gemini also allows students to seamlessly switch back and forth between the school version, which is designed to teach, and the consumer version, which will simply give them the answer. Google declined to request a comment on Common Sense Media's findings and did not respond to the substance of 8 questions posed by the monitor. Instead, company spokesperson Maggie Shields replied with a statement, "We know AI raises important questions," it read. "That's why we build with educators and experts to ensure our AI is helpful, safe by design, and grounded in pedagogy and how people actually learn. We believe technology, when used effectively with educators in the lead, unlocks student potential." The company added that school administrators have the power to turn Gemini off. Uncertainty in the classroom. Mr. Agnew said early research findings have been more positive when it comes to AI's deployment as a resource for teachers, such as assisting in the drafting of lesson plans or analyzing individual students' needs. AI can reduce teacher time spent on routine tasks, with no evidence of quality loss, according to a report his center published. AI can also be effective in streamlining administrative tasks such as scheduling school buses, Mr. Agnew says. At the Peninsula School District outside Tacoma, Mr. Hagel says he has developed AI assistants that help teachers take attendance, write up summaries of playground fights, and hone financial analysis. Common Sense Media ranks these tasks as lower risk than the deployment of AI for classroom instruction, but there are concerns nonetheless. AI can be biased, Mr. Turney says. They have been found to give women different salary negotiation advice than men and produce different evaluations of the same resume when only the name at the top has changed. Mr. Torney says his organization has found similar discrepancies when using AI to grade school assignments. When the AI chatbot grades the same paper hundreds of times, it does not always provide the same grade. The result can also be different, depending on the race and gender most commonly associated with the name at the top. Classroom teachers are often left to navigate this themselves. Mr. Chang told the monitor there has been no mandatory professional development AI training for teachers in his district. He says his focus has been on building AI literacy to help his students better understand how the technology works. In a recent chemistry class, he asked his students, 90% of whom are Latino and 80% of whom qualify for free or reduced price lunch, to pick a substance of their choice and investigate its molecular structure. One picked the styling product pomade. "What is the molecular structure of pomade that it allows you to keep your hair up?" he asked the bot. Together, they worked through questions about double bonds and single bonds, chemistry concepts they were learning in class, and how that might work in the real world. Typically, the way they use AI, it's like a Google search. You type in your question and you get some kind of output, Mr. Chang says. This way, you have to define what your input is and get information from a verified source. So we have to understand what a trustworthy source is and get in that mindset. I can't imagine the future of AI and what it might look like, Mr. Chang says. But as a teacher, I can't ignore it. The last article from your Back to School section of your Christian Science Monitor News for Monday, August 17, 2026, is entitled, Don't Just Believe, Look. Sal Khan, the founder of Khan Academy, is arguably the most visible figure in United States education. He drawn praise from figures such as Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and former First Lady Michelle Obama. His 2011 TED Talk on reinventing education garnered some 6 million views, and his free online tutorials have racked up billions of views on YouTube. So observers took notice when in May 2023, Mr. Khan declared in another TED Talk that artificial intelligence represented probably the biggest positive transformation that education has ever seen. He understood that AI could help students cheat, but he also argued it was capable of personalizing lessons for every student, essentially providing every child with a customized digital tutor. Mr. Khan developed a chatbot called KhanMigo after being given early access to ChatGPT. He touted the tool in a 60 Minutes television segment with Anderson Cooper, was featured in the book AI for Good by Atlantic staff writer Josh Terangel, and penned his own book, Brave New Words, How AI Will Revolutionize Education and Why That's a Good Thing. But the revolution has not yet materialized the way Mr. Khan predicted. In an April interview with the news site Chalkbeat, the YouTube star acknowledged that for a lot of students, KhanMigo was a non-event. Many just don't use it much, he said. Still, he remains bullish on AI's future in education. He sat down with Monitor AI Bureau Chief Aaron Glantz in July. Here are excerpts of their conversation, lightly edited for clarity and brevity. Aaron Glantz had this question. When I started reporting on AI in education, everyone pointed me to you because you were working with ChatGPT before it was known to most people. So I'm curious, what have you learned over the past few years? Sal Khan's answer, from the beginning, we were very careful that the AI wouldn't give answers, that it would be Socratic. It would nudge you forward. It would provide teachers and parents with transparency as to what was going on. But what we realized is that for a lot of students, just having that extra layer of support wasn't enough. Imagine I walk into a classroom and say, hey kids, my name is Sal. I think I'm a pretty good tutor. I'm just going to sit in the back of the room here, and if any of you have any questions, I'm happy to help you. Well, you can imagine what would happen. Some of the kids maybe would leverage it, but a lot of kids might be too embarrassed. They wouldn't know how to do it. The easiest thing for the student to do is cut and paste the Google search's AI summary, and they'll have the answer. You're offering a different path, but the students didn't necessarily engage in the way that you had hoped, right? Sal's answer, yeah. When we launched KhanMigo in 2023, we were already acutely aware ChatGPT was going to be a cheating nightmare. We have observed kids in classrooms during Khan Academy. Then they'd go to another EdTech tool that the district is paying for, throw the Khan Academy question into that, and get the answer. But I was thinking, okay, if we had resources, what would a human do? At some point, I should go walk up to the students and observe what they're doing. When they get a question wrong, they might be embarrassed to ask me. But what if I went proactively to that student and said, look, Billy, I saw that you just got that question wrong. Why don't you and I work on that a little bit? That's essentially what we have evolved into. We piloted a new version last year, and now we're rolling it out to millions of students around the country. When you get a question wrong, the AI says, hey, why don't you work with me a little bit on this question? And then the teacher can say, if you can show me that you really understand it, I'll give you credit for it. Next question. But you have to get the student to actually engage with the bot and want to learn. Answer, exactly. What you're describing is not unique to AI. I hate to say it. Even putting all technology aside, there's a lot of classrooms where kids are pretending to pay attention. This is why we have been partnering with teachers and districts so closely, because we see that when teachers make it part of the assignments, that drives engagement for most students. The first version of Conmigo was completely optional. Now it's actually in the student's incentive to work with the AI, because if the AI deems that you know it, now you get credit for it. Imagine a class of 30 students all working on their different things. We highlight the teachers that these five kids are really struggling with negative exponents. And we can now tell the teacher, you don't have to slow down all the other 25 kids, but you can take these five kids aside and assign a tutoring session with Conmigo on negative exponents. Next question. AI has problems with judgment and bias. How do you think about what AI is good for now? The next answer. Humans also have a lot of bias. There actually have been studies about how human beings grade students differently based on the perceptions of them. I don't say that to dismiss the fears of AI. I just also want to say the bar shouldn't be perfection. The goal is, could you have a system that's more consistent and less biased than the status quo? Even if you had an amazing English teacher who gives very consistent and good feedback, if that teacher has to grade 100 papers on the Great Gatsby, it's going to take them a week or two, and in many cases, the limiting factor on how much feedback you can get depends on how much bandwidth the teacher has, and the teacher is spending so much time. We do not do AI grading of full papers yet, but we do have a system that gives AI feedback on papers, and I do think in the next year it will be possible to do pretty solid Rubik's-based grading. The benefit of a technical system in that you can benchmark it. You can test it for bias, checking whether details, like a family's cultural background, in any way change the feedback that is given. Last question. We don't really have a centralized education system, and local school officials and teachers often lack information they need to make a smart decision about AI. The answer? What you're describing is very real. I've been telling every university and every school district, regardless of whether they're using Khan Academy or if they want to go completely non-tech or not. I'm like, assume kids are using AI for any take-home assignment. Even in the classroom, like when kids are on a computer screen, you need to very carefully monitor what they're doing. Even things as basic as Google are AI now. If you leave a laptop on kids' desks all day, nothing good's going to happen. What we should say is, okay, we want these kids to learn math, get a lot of reading comprehension practice, write a lot, and get a lot of feedback, and let the teacher spend energy on the human work of teaching. Things no technology can do. You can use technology like Khan Academy to drive personalized practice. Don't just believe. Look at things that have a base of evidence. For example, we work closely with Newark Public Schools. They've been deep with Khan Academy for about 4 years, and Khan Academy is a major part of why Newark is now seeing 3 times the growth in math compared to the state of New Jersey. Despite being one of the state's poorer districts, it's because of the way they have integrated the tech with human teachers. The next article in your Christian Science Monitor News of Monday, August 17, 2026, comes from the Culture section. It's entitled, In an Age of Hybrid Work, an Old Road Gets a New Twist. Route 66 encouraged movement. Now Tulsa invites people who can work anywhere to settle down. And this article is written by staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, Harry Brunius. Angela Harris needed to start her life anew. It was a daunting task to even consider, she knew. She was approaching 50, living once again in Houston, the city where she was born and raised. In the 5 years since her husband died, she had lost the sense of who she was and needed to find it somewhere else. It was like an urgency, says Ms. Harris, a senior compliance officer. I said, I can't stay here. I have to go. Work would not hold her back. She had a good job with a good salary and worked remotely, so she had the freedom to live almost anywhere she wanted. She was joining a distinctly 21st century American migration, a century after Route 66 carried generations toward jobs, opportunity, and imagined futures farther down the road. Remote work had reversed the old bargain for a small but durable class. They could take the job with them and choose the place where they'd hope to begin again. Among the dozens of American places with incentives inviting workers like Ms. Harris to settle was a city where 100 years ago, a businessman helped christen Route 66 as the Main Street of America. Ready to turn a page. Tulsa, Oklahoma once was a place you might pass through. Justin Harlan spent years trying to give strangers a reason to stay. Born in Tulsa, raised outside Kansas City, he came back for college and never left. As a recruiter for Teach for America in Oklahoma, he would ask graduates to stay 2 years in a place most knew nothing about. But he noticed something. Tulsa was always at the top of the list in terms of teachers staying behind 2 years, he says. The barrier was often just getting someone to give it a chance. Tulsa Remote, which Mr. Harlan has run since 2021, is that observation turned into organized effort. Founded in 2018 by the George Kaiser Family Foundation, in a city trying to loosen its dependence on oil and gas, it pays remote workers $10,000 to live in Tulsa for a year. The money does not buy a resident. It buys a trial. More than 4,200 people have taken it. About 80% are still there 2 years on. They arrive with jobs in hand, which Mr. Harlan calls the fairness of it. You're not taking away from a local, he says. Not everyone who applies is accepted, and the average salary of those who arrive is around $100,000. What it mostly selects for is people at a hinge. Folks experience some sort of major life change, ready to turn a page. More people can pursue this change today without looking for a new job, untethering geography from employment. Rebecca Hines began a doctorate on remote work at Stanford in September 2019, which was an odd thing to study. But within 6 months, the whole country was her laboratory. Before the pandemic, remote workers were stigmatized, she says, passed over, presumed to be slacking. Then the offices emptied and everyone was on the same screen. For the first time, many of these remote workers felt a sense of leveling, she says. Roughly 12% of full-time American employees work entirely from home, more than double what it was before the pandemic, but still far less than what many predicted 5 years ago. Hybrid work turned out to be the durable change, and about 25% split time between home and office. This past July, Mr. Harlan and Dr. Hines joined a new body devoted to the question their two careers turned on. The Remote Work Institute, a partnership between Tulsa Remote and the London School of Economics and Political Science, was launched to study remote work, an attempt, its founders say, to replace a debate driven by anecdote and headline with evidence. Who am I now? The freedom Ms. Harris had to move and reinvent herself offered possibility and promise, but carried sorrow within it. Her husband, Desmond, was a fashion photographer from New Orleans. She worked for a publishing company. They dated, then began to collaborate. Their relationship deepened, and they started a project. He was going to photograph firefighters and police officers in small American towns, and she would sell them to book publishers. So we literally were in a vehicle coast to coast, border to border, doing what we loved, Ms. Harris says. For 5 years, they were co-workers, travel companions, husband and wife in a rhythm of joy and striving. They fell ill with COVID-19 at the same time and went to the hospital together, and one day the nurses said they were moving Desmond to a different room. An hour later, he was gone. For 9 months, I did absolutely nothing, she says. I was just existing. Then her daughter from a previous marriage was pregnant with her first grandchild, so she moved back to Houston. Then her elderly father's health faltered. For a while, she was useful to others. At her father's funeral, she understood she was going to leave. much, and her deepest self remained in turmoil. Right after Desmond passed away, I immediately started asking myself, who am I now? Ms. Harris says. I mean, I know who I am, but who am I now? She had heard that some places were paying remote workers to move. She considered West Virginia and Colorado. Tulsa was a few hours up the highway, a city she had driven through once with Desmond. So about 2 years ago, she rented an apartment, sight unseen, and loaded a moving truck, the first she had ever driven, got on the road and headed north. I see colors on this canvas. Not long after she arrived, Ms. Harris shaved her head, an act of freedom, she says, in a city where no one had known her before. Then a stranger told her about a beauty pageant. I'm in a why not phase of my life, she says. In March, she flew to Maryland for the 2026 Ms. Bald and Beautiful pageant, which honors women who are bald or losing their hair, and found the company she had been missing. I don't see a lot of bald women in Tulsa, she says. To hear their stories and find your tribe, it was more than a pageant. One category asked contestants to represent that their city. Ms. Harris, still new to Tulsa, chose Greenwood, Black Wall Street, the district a white mob burned in 1921 and took from it, she says, resilience, the work of continuing to show people who you are. For the talent portion, she delivered a monologue to her late husband, thanking him, she says, for letting me know that beauty is not in what I wear, but who I am. She was named first runner-up. Her trophy sits in her apartment window facing out. Her story is what Justin Harlan and his city hope to see. Someone agrees to try Tulsa and find something they were looking for. Ms. Harris does not yet feel settled and does not intend to be. She renews the lease a year at a time. If a chance came to go overseas, she would take it. But she's decided to stay a third year in Tulsa for now. When she arrived, I felt like I was just a blank canvas, Ms. Harris says. And I had these watercolors, but no direction. It's been good since I've been here. I see colors on this canvas now that was once was empty. Next in your Christian Science Monitor news of Monday, August 17, 2026, are numbers in the news. The number 92%. The share of United States voters who feel that government corruption is a major issue, according to a recent Brennan Center survey. Voters define corruption as using elected office for personal gain, prioritizing the interests of billionaires and big corporations, and wasting taxpayer dollars. The number, 128.5 million. The amount of cash the Republican National Committee has on hand, according to the Federal Election Commission filings covering activity through June 30. By contrast, the Democratic National Committee is more than $2 million in debt, leaving the RNC with a substantial fundraising advantage heading into the midterm elections. And you have just heard the Christian Science Monitor news for Monday, August 17, 2026. I'm Mark Stangle for Mind's Eye, translating vision into audio. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.